Hi, everybody. This is the fourth session of our TiVo book study and maybe the final one, although we might have to get another overflow. What we've got in front of us are two short grapevine articles from late in TiVo's life. The first one is When the Big Guy Becomes Nobody, and that was published in the Grapevine in 65. He died in 66. So it was very, very late. And then the next one is Treating the Causes of Alcoholism. That's quite short. That was in the Grapevine in 1963. And finally, they wrap up with a speech presented to his colleagues again, where he's basically criticizing the field for not it's all of his themes, you know, psychiatrists don't, you know, are looking for deep causes and you need to treat the symptom first and all of that. So, anyway, these are two pretty good little essays. So I'll start, and that's on page 111. When the Big Eye Becomes Nobody. The AA program of help is touched with elements of true inspiration, and in no place is that inspiration more evident than in the selection of its name, Alcoholics Anonymous. Anonymity is, of course, of great protective value, especially to the newcomer, but my present target is to focus on the even greater value anonymity has in contributing to the state of humility necessary for the maintenance of sobriety in the recovered alcoholic. My thesis is that anonymity, thoughtfully preserved, supplies two essential ingredients to that maintenance. The two ingredients, actually two sides of the same coin, are first, the preservation of a reduced ego, and second, the continued presence of humility or humbleness. As stated in the 12th tradition of AA, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, reminding each member to place principles before personalities. Many of you will wonder what that word ego means. It has so many definitions that the first task is to clarify the nature of the ego needing reduction. This is actually not a rehash of what we've heard. It's a layman's view of his view of the ego, so it's really worth reading. I'll pass.
So this is Suzanne. I just wanted to make a note on something that, let's see. He's talking about anonymity, and he also refers to traditions. And I mm-hmm. think it's really, really great that he is also incorporating ego. And this is like the only place where I've ever heard anything connected with the traditions with ego. Mm. So when we're sitting in business meetings, we see it all the time.
Sure.
And so it's kind of really cool that he actually makes note of it, I think. So thanks. Well, anybody else want to share? Because I'll start. Or do you want to keep on going, or do you want me to
start reading? Go ahead. Let's pass it around.
Okay. So, and where many of you will wonder what the word ego means. It has so many definitions that the first task is to clarify the nature of the ego needing reduction. This ego is not an intellectual concept, but a state of feeling, a feeling of importance, of being special. Few people can recognize this need to be special in themselves. Most of us, however, can recognize offshoots of this attitude and put the proper name to it. Let me illustrate. Early in the AA days, I was consulted about a serious problem plaguing the local group. The practice of celebrating a year of sobriety with a birthday cake had resulted in a certain number of members getting drunk within a short period after the celebration. It seemed apparent that some could not stand prosperity. I was asked to settle between birthday cakes and no birthday cakes. Characteristically, I begged off not from shyness, but from ignorance. Some 3 or 4 years later, AA furnished me the answer. The group no longer had such a problem because, as one member said, we celebrate still, but a year of sobriety is now a dime a dozen. No one gets that much of a kick out of that anymore. You know, it's interesting because I've read this before, this section before, and I don't remember at all reading, you know, what Howard just read. And it's so interesting to me that I can pick up stuff after I've already read it before that I didn't think about. And it's the same like with the big book, that happens too, but it's kind of very refreshing to read this book and to see that I'm just such a novice with it. So thank you.
Yeah, it's pretty wonderful. Stuff leaps out. Happens to me too.
So I will, anybody else want to share or I'll pass it to Terry?
Oh, well, I'd just like to say that, this is a summation of the ego where he's gone into detail about ego factors previously. He's making a broader statement here. It's not a function of your mind. It's a state of feeling. That is, it's not an intellectual. It's how you feel about yourself and the feeling of being special. And basically, the ego is this concentration on myself, right, a self-obsession. So he's giving a different but consistent version of what ego means for his different audience.
Thank you.
So are we starting at a look at what happens?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
A look at what happens shows us ego as I see it in action. Initially, the person who has been sober for a full year was a standout, someone to be looked up to. His ego naturally expanded, his pride flowered, any previous deflation vanished. With such a renewal of confidence, he took a drink. He had been made special and reacted accordingly. Later, the special element dropped out. No ego feeds off being in the dime of a dozen category, and the problem of ego buildup vanished. Today, AA in practice is well aware of the dangers of singling anyone out for honors and praises. The dangers of reinflation are recognized. The phrase trusted servants is a conscious effort to keep that ego down, although admittedly some servants have a problem in that regard. Now let us take a closer look at this ego, which causes trouble. The feelings associated with the state of mind are basic importance in understanding the value of anonymity for the individual, the value of placing him in the rank and file of humanity. Pass.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? It talks about no ego feeds off being the dime a dozen category, but we still make pretty big deal about 1 year, right? You know, so I'm not sure that's adhered to as strongly as Thibault saw back in his day. But the general warning of, and we praise people, who are doing things for service, for instance, which, I love to hear that. It's my ego that loves to hear that. So I don't know. I understand his point. I'm just thinking that the environment that I'm, going to meetings in now is somewhat different from what he's describing.
It's Suzanne, and the one thing, or the way that I kind of look at this, is that when people start feeling better in recovery. Mm-hmm. And I started feeling better too in recovery. And what I've noticed is that it for me, it's like I just had so many things that I still needed to work on. So that's what like pulled me back into, working the steps over and over again and going to any length, because I recognized that I had a lot of, I was just multi-addicted. And the thing is that if I notice, like, some people will become successful in whatever it is, whether it's like in the program and become, like, I was actually warned about circuit speaking, that a lot of circuit speakers end up going out, and that you have to be really careful. And I've also noticed that with people's professionally getting moving forward, and people getting married, people having kids, just all that kind of stuff, and you can take a big step backwards if you that's just the reality of what I've seen. And it comes out of, that piece of ego. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, as I sit here and just kind of talk about it, I can think of, people are flashing through my head, this person, that person, this person. So I'm glad that he's talking about it and talking all more about how ego really can get us in trouble and why we have to work a diligent program. Now, for me, what's happened is that it's pushed me into, doing new things and being very successful in certain things. But with that success, for me, has come things that have been really tricky in terms of, like, self-confidence. When you are, when you do become more successful, you have to build your self-confidence too, and that's what keeps me in the program, because I'm in these situations that are different that I haven't been in. I don't have a lot, I have my support system of, my 12-step communities, but, if you are outside of that or leave that or, happen to be lucky to have, your family community or career community or whatever, I think that's where things can, get tricky again. And for me, it was just so important to be recognizing, like, my 10 steps, like whenever I feel uncomfortable, it doesn't have to be a big deal that's making me uncomfortable. I have to look at those little things, because it's those little things that build up. Mm-hmm. And what's fortunate is, like, yeah, maybe I won't go out and take a drink, but I've got a lot of other things before that, because I'm in OA, I don't drink coffee anymore. I'm not really interested in doing that anymore. I'm really not interested in eating sugar anymore either. But it's like there's just these little pieces of, like, food behaviors that I have to be, that I watch. And if I don't, watch these pieces, and those are the pieces that connect me back to that, to be very, very diligent about doing that 10th step.
No,
thank you.
Yeah. Well, he's calling out that ego, isn't he? Pretty clearly, even though, as I said, I think the people get, there are, there are islands of, people continue to build up other people's egos. And I, if I allow that, if I go with that, I'm in trouble. And it's not their fault, right? I pick up on it and I eat that praise. And I become swollen on that praise, and then I'm in danger, big danger. So, I guess certain qualities typify this ego, which views itself as special and therefore different. It is high on itself and prone to keep its goals and visions at the same high level. It disdains what it sees as grubs who plod along lacking the fire and inspiration of those who are sparked by ideals that lift people out of the commonplace and offer promise of better things to come. Often the same ego operates in reverse. It despairs of man with his faults and failings and develops a cynicism that sours the spirit and makes of its possessor a cranky realist who finds nothing good in this veil of tears. Life never quite meets his demands upon it, and he lives in an embittered existence, grabbing what he can out of the moment, but never really part of what goes on around him. He seeks love and understanding and prates endlessly about his sense of alienation from those around him. Basically, he's a disappointed idealist, forever aiming high and landing low. Both of these egos confuse humbleness with humiliation. I think it is one of the most remarkable passages in the whole papers. I mean, he's wrapping this up, all the technical stuff he's talked about the ego, and he's applying it to the broader sweep of a personality that is driven by ego. And there's so much in that that I recognize for myself. And it's really a great summation of what we've read so far.
I also like that he talks about often the same ego operates in reverse.
Yes.
Because we do, or some of us, do really trash ourselves, find our faults and our failings.
I was a speaker last night, and she was talking about the things she knows about herself but she can't do. And so she doesn't do them. You know, it's old tapes, you know, typical sort of thing. But the way she put it was, you know, she tells herself a story about, you know, why she'll fail at this, and therefore she doesn't try, never gets there. And I just totally related to it. It's like, it's fear, right? Fear of the future. And it's the ego, too, though. I don't want to expose myself to failure, you know. And that's the second class, I think. Disappointed idealist. I can't get what I see in my brain out there in the world, and, you know, and so I give up and I say, no, I'm not going to try for that. And that's just as much ego as thinking you can do anything. So I totally relate to this passage.
Yeah, that's really great. That's a really great comment that you just made. I don't think people associate ego with, it's self-centeredness and selfishness and kind of arrogance in just the opposite mm-hmm. way.
Yep.
Would you like me to continue?
Sure.
To develop this further, the expression "you think you're something" nicely catches the sense of being above the crowd. Children readily spot youngsters who think they are something and do their best to puncture that illusion. For instance, they play a game called tag. In it, the one who is tagged is called it. You've heard them accuse each other saying, "you think you're it," thereby charging the other with acting as though he was better than his mates. In their own way, children make very good therapists or head shrinkers. They are skillful puncturers of inflated egos, even though their purpose is not necessarily therapeutic. AA had its start in just such a puncturing. Bill W. always refers to his experience at Towns Hospital as a deflation in great depth, and on occasion has heard to say that his ego took a hell of a licking. AA stems from that deflation and that licking. Clearly, the sense of being special, of being something, has its dangers, its drawbacks for the alcoholic. Yet the opposite, namely that one is to be a nothing, has little counter appeal. The individual seems faced with being a something and getting drunk, or being a nothing and getting drunk from boredom. that's great.
Yeah.
I mean, it just kind of says it all there. And it's go ahead.
Well, just what about me? I'll be the hole in the donut. You know, that's what that's expressing. You know, if I let go of myself, if I let go of my ego, what will become of me? You know, and he's going to go on to say, you know, it runs counter to all our desires for identity. And that's the fear that I faced when looking at a surrender to a higher power.
And what it was reminding me of is the fear inventory. When you take a look at something that you're fearful of, like money, not making enough money, and then you look at the opposite of it, is then, okay, yes, now I'm making a lot of money, what do I do with it? Or I'm scared that I'm going to lose it, or, you know, whatever. But it seems like just that either or, I can't be satisfied, and that's why I need higher power, because, right. You know, I really need God to ground me.
So, I have an unsatisfiable mind.
Yes, that's great.
Bob Anderson liked to say that.
Yeah, that's really good. Sherry, would you like to read?
Sure. The apparent dilemma rests upon a false impression upon the nature of nothingness as a state of mind. The ability to accept ourselves as nothing is not easily developed. It runs counter to all our desires for identity. For an apparently meaningful existence, one filled with hope and promise. To be nothing seems a form of psychological suicide. We cling to our somethingness with all of its strength at our command. The thought of being a nothing is simply not acceptable. But the fact is that that person who does not learn to be as nothing cannot feel that he is but a plain, ordinary, everyday kind of person who merges with the human race, and as such is humble, lost in the crowd, and essentially anonymous. When that can happen, the individual has a lot going for him. People with nothing on their mind can relax, go about their business quietly, and with a minimum of fuss and bother. They can even enjoy life as it comes along. In AA, this is called the 24-hour program, which really signifies the fact that the individual does not have tomorrow on his mind. He can live in the present and find his pleasure in the here and now. He is hustling nowhere. With nothing on his mind, the individual is receptive and open-minded. Pass.
Yeah. What about me? I'll be like the hole in the donut. I guess I'll get all that, won't I? And what I got when I cleared the deck of my own self, you know, involvement is a better understanding of my place in the universe. You know, that I'm in God's universe. And I don't think I became nothing. I became something different, though. I became something that was had more humility. But, okay, so, any other comments?
Okay, no, I don't have any.
Okay. So the great religions are conscious of the need for nothingness if one is to attain grace. In the New Testament, Matthew 18, chapter 18, 3-4, quotes Christ with these words, "Truly I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child, he's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." Zen teaches the release of nothingness. A famous series of pictures designed to show growth in man's nature ends with a circle enclosed in a square. The circle depicts man in a state of nothingness. The square represents the framework of limitations. Man must learn to live with them. In this blank state, nothing is easy, nothing hard. And so Zen, too, has linked nothingness, humbleness, and grace. Anonymity is a state of mind of great value to the individual and maintaining sobriety. While I recognize its protective function, I feel that any discussion of it would be one-sided if it failed to emphasize the fact that the maintenance of a feeling of anonymity, of a feeling of I am nothing special, is a basic insurance of humility and so a basic safeguard against further trouble with alcohol. This kind of anonymity is truly a precious possession. So I really like that article. It's is late in his career, and he's summing up stuff to a non-technical audience, and it's a masterful, sweeping summing up of his whole attitude towards ego, and it's just great to read.
I also like that you can see his growth, because in the earlier things that he was talking about, you know, he doesn't talk about religion at all, and in this talk, he talks about Christianity, and then he talks about Zen. So he was open-minded, and that's, I think, what's really interesting about Dr. Thibeault. The other thing is when he's saying, I am nothing special, I don't think it's not a negative, like we're putting ourselves down. It's a neutral. It's really like, I'm equal to you and you're equal to me. So.
Yes, I think that's what he's saying throughout that. You're right. And, it's a position of neutrality. It's an open-minded position. It's where I'm not letting my thoughts about myself interfere with my God consciousness that's teaching me new things. You know, so I'm teachable. I can change if I'm not holding on to my ego so much.
Great.
So this next one's pretty cool. You're talking about, it's very short, we're talking about the spiritual angles, quote unquote. There's no angle, that's what it is. But it acknowledges the spiritual content of AA in a way that's more forthcoming than any other thing that we read in these papers, I think. Very short. It's called Treating the Causes of Alcoholism. Was it you, Suzanne, next?
Yes. Treating the Causes of Alcoholism. I like the article, An AA Doctor's Prescription, which appeared in a previous issue of The Grapevine. It nicely stressed the importance of stopping the symptom of drinking. The picture showing the roots and fruits of alcoholism is graphic and intelligible. The concept, the treatment of a symptom, is, I am sure, a sound one. The emphasis on the removal of the symptom can, however, be misleading. It suggests a failure to reach the fundamentals and implies that the systematic cure leaves the individual skating on thin ice with the underlying causes of the trouble still lurking in the background, ready at any moment to trap up the individual. The charge of superficiality may well be levied against a treatment that thinks only in terms of symptoms. The truth, however, is that routinely to assume superficiality is also an error. Sometimes the treatment of a symptom hits into the deeper structures while it takes care of the symptom itself. The history of medicine is dotted with examples in the remedy of a symptom provided the cure of the condition. A classic illustration is malaria. The malarial patient has had a symptom, a fever. Quinine cured this fever and was in use over the centuries, long before the cause had been determined. The therapy was completely symptomatic, yet, as it is now known, actually has a scientific basis. The malarial parasite was killed by the drug. Would you like me to go on another paragraph, or would you like me to stop? Okay, in other words, treatment discovered by chance in nature, in a funny sense, reversed the usual sequence. Science says first the cause and remedy, that thus curing the illness. Instead, the use of quinine treated the symptom of fever with no reference to the cause, which only later was revealed. The charge of superficiality was disproved by facts uncovered subsequently. And I'll keep on reading a little bit more because I think it's all connected.
Yes.
AA is also a therapy discovered by chance. To be sure, the original members followed brilliantly the clues with which their own experience had presented them. They learned from experiencing. They followed no book. They found a method, a program. They prescribed it, and it worked. The idea of seeking causes was discarded, sometimes noisily and with jeers at those who still tried to be scientific. Yet AA, like quinine, was designed not only to cure the symptom of drinking, but also to tackle and, if possible, eradicate its causes. The AA program helped the individual remain sober, thus removing the symptoms. It also aimed at altering the inner source of discord by its stress on spiritual development, thereby getting at the causes that provoked the symptoms.
Yeah. So there you have it. He's, you know, it's one thing, it's jarring every time a TiVo read that he's just treating a symptom, but you have to understand that he's meaning from a psychiatric point of view, it's all the elements in your psyche that came together so that your ego wasn't developed, and it's not like what we're looking at, which is, you know, a damaged character that's in need of God, higher power to redeem and come and change, you know. But now he's nodding. He says, oh, yes, okay, this is late again. This is 1963, so it's later in his career. So he's come to an understanding of the curative nature of, well, see, he talks later about a cure. I won't, he says no cure is possible, but you have to just stop, you know, but anyway.
You know, it came to me when I hear in the program, you know, we have a disease, and then when people talk about their medicine, like going to meetings, is there medicine, working the steps, is there a medicine, using the tools of whatever mm-hmm. program they're in, is there medicine? And that's what this reminded me of.
Mm.
It's a good place, I think, when people use that phrase, you know, to point them to, you know, TiVo. Because, you know,
yeah.
You know, say, you know, this explains it more in more detail. Yes, it is our medicine.
I just think earlier on he wasn't weighing the spiritual solution, and he was looking at purely as a psychiatrist looking at the scientific underpinnings, and he said you couldn't, you know, and later in the next paper he's going to talk about getting a full history that is totally decoding, going back to childhood in classic analytic terms, right? And saying, you know, well, this happened to you, that happened to you, your mother didn't feed you properly, et cetera, you know. And from that, deriving a picture of the psyche of the person and then understanding why that psyche is drinking and therefore then being able to change that psyche so that it doesn't drink, so the person doesn't drink, and that fails. So that's a treatment of it. That's trying to treat causes from a psychiatric point of view. But what he's saying is he's treating the symptom, which is you attack drinking. You confront that firsthand. And, you know, his first impression of AA was that was just its stopping function, you know. And he knew that, oh, yes, well, there's this moral psychology that goes on. But he never really emphasizes it. But now here later in his career, he's admitting that spiritual practice, the spiritual training that we do and the journey that we get on is the curative, is the thing that addresses the deep symptoms, the deep causes of alcoholism. So it's a welcome, for me, a welcome clarification of Thibault's outlook on this stuff.
Terry, would you like to continue?
The fact is that as spiritual growth proceeds, the underlying hostile elements are steadily reduced in strength and thus in their capacity to cause trouble. Psychiatric therapy, depending upon analytic concepts, had tried to reach and uproot the hidden hostilities that poison the psyche, the assumptions being that such unearthing would be free for the individual from the grip and enable him to pursue a more healthy path. Unfortunately, the uncovering method had no way of ensuring removal. the individual came acquainted with his hostilities and had no means of getting rid of them. A adopted a very different approach. A found a very basic fact, namely the spiritual growth is a real antidote for the hostile negative forces. It learned that these feelings do not have to be uncovered, but that somehow the spiritual elements can neutralize the negative forces, thus freeing the individual from their grip. In that way, the cause of the condition is an effective extirpated, is that the word?
Extirpated, I think.
Yeah.
Root out and destroy.
Okay. Like quinine, which actually killed the organism, A, through its spiritual emphasizes, actually may succeed in ridding the individual of harmful attitudes and feelings that had contributed to his difficulties. AA, so to speak, cures without uncovering. Pass.
Yeah, so, that's just what I talked about going into that. So the point, Suzanne, you got a comment?
No, thanks. Thanks for asking.
Okay. So AA adopted a very different approach. AA found, next paragraph. The point of my comment has now been made. AA is not to be considered merely a symptomatic remedy, though its stress on the spiritual, it really digs much deeper. Like quinine, it tackles the original causes. Unfortunately, here the parallel ends. The malarial parasite is specific and can be destroyed. The evils with which the spiritual ailment must contend are not so readily wiped out. The most one can hope for is progress in the amelioration of the hostilities and growth in the positive forces that ensure health. And amelioration means make something better, make it better. As a result of this thinking about AA and how its program works, I would like to suggest a companion picture. The tree would have a trunk with roots and branches. The trunk would be labeled the spiritual life and or sobriety. The roots would have titles like love, warmth, charity, gratitude, friendship, forgiveness, kindliness. The limbs would be covered with leaves or blossoms and would indicate somehow the overflowing horn of plenty, the abundant life. This, as I see it, is the miracle not only of AA, but of all life, the capacity to move from a negative to a positive way of life. One final point, this time about how the psychiatrist fits into this picture. In my eyes, he has a dual task. He can help to remove blocks, i.e. the hostilities to spiritual growth, and also do what he can to foster the processes that lead to that growth. Unless he is mindful of both aspects, he is likely to be of little help. He can no more afford to overlook the spiritual than can any member of AA. So, gee whiz. I really like that one.
Yeah, that is really nice talk.
Short but sweet.
Yeah.
So this final article is what? 126. It's 5 pages, about, maybe a little more. We got 15 minutes left. It's he's saying the same thing to his colleagues. Is basically you have to. You can't take your education in psychiatry that tells you to look for these underlying causes exclusively. You can't do that because it doesn't work in the way he just outlined. And that you have to rely on your experience, and that there's no body of experience. This was earlier, 1956. So there's no body of experience that shows us what the right treatment ought to be. No clinical experience being built up. Because basically a lot of therapists just give up because their training doesn't work because alcoholics are different. So that's that in a nutshell. What do you think?
I think we can start it. I don't think we'll finish everything, and then at our next meeting we can finish it and then just kind of have a general discussion on the end, you know, of our experiences reading this and with the book.
That sounds good.
How does that Okay.
Any more comments on what we just read?
The only comment that I have is that I found it interesting. I didn't catch this last time that I read it, but I have made a note on the final paragraph saying that if you do therapy, you really have to see a psychiatrist who knows AA. And then next title is called Why Psychiatrists Fail with Alcoholics. And I like the way, I just think it's a really beautiful illustration, a prose illustration that he gives us with the trunk and these roots with titles like love, warmth, charity, gratitude, friendship, forgiveness, kindness, kindliness. The limbs would be covered with leaves or blossoms and would indicate somehow that the overflowing horn of plenty, the abundant life. This, as I see, is the miracle not only of AA, but of all life, the capacity to move from a negative to a positive way of life. And I think, you know, for healthy people, they're able to, you know, do that without a 12-step program. They're able to do that without getting themselves into all kinds of difficulties, getting addicted to anything. You know, they're able to move through life. They have difficult times, too, but they've got inner resources that I don't have. And I think that what I have noticed in my own life in recovery is that I was surprised when I ended up, I had been invited to go to this conference, and long story short, just I became friends with this one man who I'm still friends with today, and let me tell you, our lives are so, our childhoods are just so opposite. I mean, you can get more opposite. And yet we, and he's, you know, absolutely, you know, not an addict at all. And yet we're both interested in spirituality and how our lives kind of, that's where our lives cross. And I just find that really interesting that even with a dysfunctional background, we can really truly heal, or at least, you know, I've been able to heal to a point that I can have these very interesting friends whose lives, you know, we've come together from, you know, different backgrounds, but we've still come together, and I think that's, that was kind of a really neat insight for me to be able to see that. I felt that it was really showed me how much my higher power really had worked in healing. So thanks.
Yeah, a lot of different paths.
A lot of different paths to the same place.
So do you want to start with Why Psychiatrists Fail?
Sure. So why psychiatrists fail with alcoholics? While no one is more convinced than I am that alcoholism is a disease, no one is more appalled than I am at the blithe manner with which the concept has been received and the easy use to which it has been put. To paraphrase Winston Churchill's famous war statement, I could say, never has so much been done on so little with so much hullabaloo. I can say this quite frankly. I was in on the early hullabaloo and did a certain amount of it myself. I cannot help but feel that the whole field of alcoholism is way out on a limb that any minute will crack and drop us all in a frightful mess. I sometimes tremble to think of how little we have to back up our claims. Yet, actually, I would not have it otherwise, nor do I think it could have happened differently. All movements get underway through someone or some group taking a chance. This has to be. The only danger comes from failure. Later on, to see things in perspective, we should never be fooled by our own
Ballyhoo
into any false sense about our accomplishments. The need to do something about alcoholism is admitted. The main question concerns the tools we have available to carve out satisfactory results. To me, they still seem pretty crude and makeshift.
Yeah.
That's a great, great paragraph.
Yeah. So his opening thesis is that the field of alcoholism is in trouble. It doesn't have a real consensus on how treatment ought to be, and so anyway, he'll go on and develop that.
And I think there are still pieces of that, especially today with treatment centers. A lot of treatment centers going away from AA, at least where I live, and going into like this kind of just a different model.
Yeah, CBT, DBT, mainly.
Mm-hmm.
Very much in vogue.
I like the words that he uses, so hullabaloo and ballyhoo. Yeah.
Well, you know, they were about to come up with a TV show called Hullabaloo.
Yeah, they had one, didn't they?
Rock and roll bands, weekly dance show. Totally apropos of nothing. So, you want to continue?
We'll have Terry continue.
Okay. This fact, while it is to be deplored, cannot be used to condemn. It is to outgrow the forces over which we, as a group, had little or no control. The failed like Topsy, just grown. First it was the research council, then it was the people at Yale in mighty impetus of Alcoholics Anonymous. Finally, it was the organizational and educational work of the National Committee on Alcoholism. The question now is, what do we face, those of us who are actively engaged in meeting the problem? Have we not almost promised to do a job with very little real right to say anything more than we'll try? Have enough for our energies been devoted to helping us get down off the limb towards establishing a reliable body of data and experience that will enable us to develop competent practitioners in the field of alcoholism? I very much doubt it. There are undoubtedly many reasons for this failure to establish reliable information on alcoholism. One, however, strikes as of great importance because it is subtle, not generally recognized. The fact that the person who enters the field of alcoholism comes from other fields. More than they realize, they are bringing something to the field and have little expectations of learning anything from that field, nor do they feel any particular need to do this. They have already been taught, not that they apply what they know. It does not take them long to realize that what they know does not amount to much when it comes to handling alcoholics. Pass.
Yeah, so this is his basic thesis that therapists don't know what they're getting into when they're treating alcoholics.
Although I think, you know, he's writing this in the 60s. In the 50s still? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there has been a switch. And I think the switch came more in the 80s in terms of you can get a degree with a certificate, or you can get a certificate of alcohol studies.
Yeah.
So there has, I think, been some movement on that front to educate people.
Yeah. I think things have changed quite a bit. And what is that, 40 years? No,
yeah.
It's 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
1956, that was then.
Mm-hmm. Although I think there's still differences of opinion still.
Well, you still have, you know, psychiatrists are looking at psychotherapy still, you know, and they have different methods to do psychotherapy, but it's still the basically the same enterprise, which is, you know, decoding the psyche and treating it, which is still not at odds with, it can be complementary to, but it's not the same thing as trying to live a spiritual life. And the two are complementary if you work them right, which is his point here, I think. It's that, his basic point here is that they're not developing this body of information because people bail on alcoholics because they're too frustrating because they don't have the tools to deal with. So I think that changed. I think you're right.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, too, is that there are psychiatrists who come from an alcoholic background who are, you know, have had alcoholic problems, now are able to recognize them, or come from dysfunctional families. So, you know, and since in the most or many psychiatrists, you know, who went through the 60s, 70s, and 80s possibly were and were, you know, if you look at Timothy Leary experimenting with drugs. And the other thing there was something else that I was going to say, too, about, a lot of psychiatrists are really into spirituality, or at least where I live. There's a number of psychiatrists who have incorporated that into their practice, or are doing something creative with it. Same with, you know, their therapists too. So I think it's not as, you know, there has been movement, is all I'm saying. Thank you.
Combining the approaches is obviously a fruitful way to go, and some psychiatrists do that. The official, you know, the science of psychology does not admit of spiritual solutions. They want to define it purely in psychological terms. And so, you know, I had a therapist who said, "Well, God is just the best thing you can think of." So, in other words, it was sort of like my conscience, what I believed was the best thing, and that was something I aspired to. And that was how God functions psychologically, according to him. And apparently that's a fairly widespread approach. But you're totally right that there are therapists who are dialed in. And it just makes sense to, you know, because it works. It works so well, you know.
I also think because you have these new fields, you've got transpersonal psychology, you've got somatic psychology, you've got spiritual direction now. You've got a lot of theologians who have some kind of degree in therapy degree on top of their study of theology. So I just think it's kind of an interesting, you know, where we just definitely have made progress in those areas, And I think it's for the better of all of us that we're not stuck with just having, like, a very conservative approach in the field. So it's almost time to end.
Yes.
So, Lee, would you like to take us out, or anybody else have any comments they want to make before we end?
Yeah, one second. I just want to make sure that we got the bookmark right. So we're at two reactions, right?
Yeah, that's where I think we are.
And what page is that on in your hard copy?
122.
Okay, so that's where we're going. Next time.
Anybody have any further comments? So, Lee, would you like to lead us in a prayer of your choice?
Yeah, sure. my creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen.
Thank you.
Amen. Thanks, everybody.